This is Craig Collins with You've Binge Challenged. This week, my guest is Chris Duffy, who has one of the most amazing voices in radio.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And the show is MASH, which is just an incredible show. And a lot of people challenged me to this show when I first decided to launch this podcast. But you know what? I'll give it to you because, like I said, you've got one of the best voices I've heard around here. And you deserve to be on a podcast, my friend.
Well, thank you. actually, you just said pick a topic, and I just randomly pulled this one out of my butt. So, so we're talking MASH.
Yeah, well, and the first thing I'm going to ask you, and it's what I kind of say to start the conversation, what was it outside of just pulling it out of your butt that made you like this show so much that it would be something you'd pick for this?
That one's easy, and I think anybody over a certain age can relate with me because this was the television show that all of our dads and our grandpas watched because it was in reruns almost immediately. Mm-hmm. Within a couple of years, it was actually one of the first big, you know, syndicatable rerun sitcom of the 70s. And so it was, you know, it always seemed to be that TV show that was on after the news at 7 o'clock when your old man or your grandpa was like settling in after dinner and just wanted to watch some TV, and you were there too. You had nothing better to do. So I think when you're of a certain age, you know, you've
It's funny you mentioned that actually, because as I was watching this show, I actually did remember a couple episodes, mm-hmm. and that had to be from my childhood, sitting down with my grandfather after dinner, exactly as you describe, and just being told, this is a good show, watch this. And I was like six.
Right. And in the, you know, in the pantheon of sitcoms of the era, you know, this was kind of the most guy friendly, you know. I mean, it was, you know, there were soldiers and there was war and there was, but it was somehow crazily they got a comedy out of it. So,
well, that's actually the most remarkable thing. Cause the other thing I remember about my grandfather, and he did serve, is that he loved to watch war movies. It was just a big thing. That was his genre. And when I watched this show for the podcast, I was amazed at how funny it could be within the context of what it was, within the setting, everything else that's happening around these characters, for them to constantly instill. And that's probably predominantly because Alan Alda is so incredible in the role that he was given, I think.
Alan Alda is incredible. The writing behind it, and of course, it, you know, the whole sitcom came out of the 1970 film.
Yeah.
With Elliot Gould
some other people.
Yeah, some other
Gary
people.
Berghoff.
Yeah, right. But the writing behind this sitcom, and in fact, it was a great era for writing where mm-hmm. television comedy just sort of made it to the next level. Yeah. I mean, we went from, you know, Hogan's Heroes and Gilligan's Island, and then a few years later, we've got Norman Lear with All in the Family. We've got MASH.
Yeah.
We've got Soap. So, you
well,
know.
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned the writing to me because one thing that I noticed. Because I jumped, what I did is I watched some of the first season, but I thought it would be a disservice to the show to only really get the perspective of the first season. There's major characters that are introduced in the fourth season and later on because some people just walked away from the show. Some were surprisingly killed off in that third season finale. And I guess this is kind of the question. The finales of each season of this show got progressively incredibly strong. There's one, the fourth season, where they just do a long form interview. I don't know if you remember this episode.
Right.
A reporter goes in and interviews everyone, mm-hmm. and the things they say, I don't think that episode was funny at all. I think there were almost no laughs.
Well,
it was impactful.
To understand it, first of all, you have to go back to the era in which it came out in. Okay, the first episode of MASH aired in September of 1972. Mm-hmm. The Vietnam War was in full swing. You know, we were actually, it was already sort of a cynical endeavor. And I think, you know, the general push in the American culture was going against the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So along comes this sitcom that starts talking about sort of the futility and dark comedy of war. Of course, it was based in Korea. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it didn't really have that, you know, it's not like you were talking still.
It wasn't direct social commentary.
Right, exactly. And so there was that, and that was the genius of the writing, and I think a lot of what attracted people to it. It mm-hmm. was a way where they could deal with war without just the heaviness of it.
Yeah.
And eventually, the writers started to notice that. They started to notice that they did have a comedy on their hands, and they were sort of backseating the horror of war.
Right.
And eventually they wanted to, you know, remind people, hey, you know, as if the, you know, the reports from Vietnam every day, you know, maybe have you know, you've gotten sort of cold to that, mm-hmm. you know, let's remind you that this, you know, the war is not a funny thing. And while there can be insane, futile, dark, comedic moments in war, as we see in every episode of MASH.
Yep. Yep.
And it's amazing how many people who have served can tell you, and I have not, but...
how realistic some of that
is? Well, they tell you, they knew a guy like Frank Burns. They knew a guy like Radar O'Reilly. They, you know, they knew all the sayings and the isms and how the bureaucracy of the Army was just an absolute... you know, train wreck.
Yeah.
And all of that comes through in MASH.
Yeah, you're right. That's an interesting message that there's these doctors very, very close to the front lines, I guess, is where MASH is. And I forget what MASH stands for, some sort of mobile...
Mobile Army Surgical Hospital.
Thank you. There you go. Yeah, right.
Our famous MASH was the 4077th.
Of course.
It was located, and they hint at this, near the village of Wijambu, which is kind of in the central part of Korea.
Wow.
During the course of the whole series, which, by the way, I think went 7 years longer than the actual Korean War, you know, the enemy is closer and then farther, and they're on the front lines, mm-hmm. and then they're on the back and everything. So they kind of keep up with that.
Well, and I didn't see this. A lot of the episodes I saw, although in the fourth season, they reference actually having bombs dropped on the hospital. Does that happen? Is there an episode where they actually get attacked?
Yeah, there's actually
directly?
Okay. Well, there's actually an episode called Bombed. And,
wow.
And and there's a couple of episodes like that. One of them, it's the enemy bombing them, and one of them, it's their own artillery, and they keep screaming at their own artillery to stop it, and the guys are all off at a Bob Hope show. So they can't get, you know, nobody can't get through.
That's
to
amazing.
Anybody. Yeah.
Yeah. And terrifying. It's really the duplicity, the difference and kind of the way that they introduce so many different aspects of what it would be like to legitimately serve and that kind of thing. It is so amazing. And one of the first things I noticed, of course, is that as you progress through the first three or four seasons, you're introduced to kind of two main characters, Alan Alda's character, Hawkeye, and then one
Benjamin
other character.
Benjamin Franklin Pierce.
Yep. And then one other character, Trap, who's this kind of equal in some ways. And then as the show moves on, I think this is what made the actor pretty upset. He is kind of place in the background. More and more often, it seems that Alan Alda's Hawkeye character is the star of the show.
Well, first of all, let me go back to what you said before. By the early 70s, the sitcom format was kind of settling into place.
Sure.
In other words, there was the pilot, the season premiere. The networks would make a big deal of it during the course of the summer. And, you know, their premiere season, when they showed all the new episodes, started in the fall when the kids were back to school.
Right.
And, you know, there was usually a Christmas episode by now, and they had a season finale, too, because they wanted to keep the buzz going. MASH in its first year did horribly. In fact, one of the, one of the modern criticisms is a show like MASH couldn't survive, you know, wouldn't get past its first season in modern television. But gradually, you know, the writing and the characters started to catch on, and so they did. They kept that format going. But by the third season, it was blatantly obvious that Alan Alda had become kind of the star.
It's funny you say it that way, because it is interesting to me. It's the fleshing out of the characters, kind of deciding what each person is, what the show is. It seems like a lot of TV shows in their first season are really trying to figure out what they are. A current example, which is not at all in comparison to MASH for quality of a TV show, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is one of very few shows that got renewed, even though its first season was pretty terrible, because of its connection to the Marvel movies that we see.
Right, you know.
And it has, in 3 years, sort of developed into a show that I think more people would say is good, as opposed to saying it's bad. And that's kind of the same thing that MASH and even the characters within MASH would struggle with. I think that if Trap had stayed, the person who played that character had
Wayne
been willing
Rogers.
To stay, Wayne Rogers had been willing to stay, as we see with BJ Honeycutt, you actually do get more of a character there that maybe they were waiting to develop until they had finished Alan Alda's Hawkeye, and we know exactly who he is, exactly what he's going to do. Maybe you can then devote more time, Or I don't know. I don't know what your perspective is.
Well,
of trap.
You got to also remember the formula of the age. You know,
yeah.
Carol O'Connor was Archie Bunker. You know, it was an ensemble cast, and they were all, you know, very well-known characters. But
sure.
Archie was in charge. Over on ABC on Happy Days, you know, that was another ensemble cast. Mm-hmm. And by 1975, 76, Henry Winkler and the Fonz had become like everybody, you know, yeah. was following him. So there was a tendency at the time when you put a lot of characters out there, one of them was going to click with the audience. And you know, the People magazines and the TV guides would start, you know, featuring these
sure.
stars. So Wayne Rogers, yeah, you know, I mean, he just sort of he bailed. And as did McLean Stevenson, too.
Oh, really?
McLean Stevenson was only in his third year of a 5-year contract. But yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the writing, too. I think Wayne Rogers kind of knew that they were writing for Alan Alda now. And in fact, by the third season, Alan Alda had a lot of creative input on how the shows were being written and directed, too. So I think, you know, Wayne Rogers was definitely feeling a little second fiddle.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting to me, and I read this, is that the novels themselves, which the movie and, of course, the TV show are based on, there's a little bit of difference. The trap character is actually the head of the surgical team. He's actually much more of a co-lead character, and that's what Wayne Rogers signed up to be. At least that's what he said he signed up to be. And then, like you said, and I don't know if that was what I'm trying to say is I don't know if the intention going in season one, episode one of MASH was this is Alan Alda, he's leading the show. I think that just organically happened. Because of how much he brought to the table, how well he was, how talented he was at demonstrating the anger that someone doing that profession would have.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I would absolutely agree with that. He, you know, I think there was some artistry going into casting him.
Yeah, sure.
And I think there was some artistry going into developing too him mm-hmm. too. But they, you know, when the show started out, it was sort of every man for himself. I mean, there could have been some magic, you know, around, you know, Father Mulcahy or something
right.
that just made him pop.
It's good that you mentioned that because there actually is an episode, and this is one of I've never done this before where I asked you to give me some specific episodes to check out throughout, and you mentioned a few, and one was a Father Mulcahy episode where he really does shine. His character really truly does shine, and it's a very difficult episode. Do you want to talk a little bit about that one?
Which
specifically?
One is that?
That's the one with Swayze.
Oh, yeah. That was from, I think, season 6 or 7. And it's yeah. really, you know, looking through the past with,
yeah.
you know, what we know now, it's really kind of an eerie.
Well, you're right. Exactly. Because actually Patrick Swayze's character is a
soldier. Right. He's in for a minor wound. His buddy next to him is got a bad wound
yep.
and he offers up to give him blood for the transfusion. Yep. So the doctors are all like, great, that'll work. During the course of the process, they figure out that Patrick Swayze's character has cancer.
Yeah.
And he's going to die of leukemia. Mm-hmm. Now, we all know what happened to Patrick Swayze.
Right.
So when you're watching this episode, which was filmed 20 years before Patrick Swayze died, and he does look very young in it, you're just like, wow. But that is a great episode for Father Francis Mulcahy. you know, people ask me, you know, are you religious? I'm like, well, I'm a Catholic, but I'm kind of a Father Mulcahy Catholic, you know.
That's perfect.
He was kind of light on the judgment.
He was.
You know, heavy on the, you know, let bygones be guys.
Well, it's yeah, because that is kind of the character that I had grown accustomed to. In that specific episode, though, the archbishop or someone
right,
to
right.
that caliber is coming to the camp. So he becomes a little bit more stern. He starts to yell at all the people
He starts
around.
To yell
yeah.
at everybody. He starts
to behave better, you know, yeah.
He
right.
starts to go a little Frank Burns on everybody.
Uh-huh.
And then he realizes when he discovers that this young soldier is going to die, but he's still only thinking of his buddy.
Yeah.
He realizes how petty he's being. It's a really kind of a remarkable performance.
No, it's an exceptional. It's one thing that they handled really well was religion. I don't know if it's because when you go to war, there must be some sort of inherent curiosity with religion more so than at other
times.
I don't know.
There are no atheists in foxholes.
I've heard that.
Yeah, as the saying goes. But
so the TV show does an excellent job, and some of them are the ones that you suggested to me. There's another episode where a soldier is convinced he's Jesus,
mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ. And that episode was very impactful because of, again, the way it was handled from all the characters' perspectives, the way the TV show handles taking something like that on.
You know, it's funny, in the more muscular Reagan era, which came in the 80s, you know, and MASH went off the air.
83?
Yeah. And in the Reagan era, MASH was kind of viewed as a liberal exercise. Alan Alda was clearly a liberal both on TV and off TV in some of his views. But I happen to think that that episode, Quo Vadis, Captain Chandler, where the young soldier claims to be Jesus Christ, is one of the most Christian, pro-Christian television shows ever created.
Yeah.
Because, you know, here's this, you know, they're in this insanity of war, and this guy shows up, he says he's Jesus, and no one believes him. Everybody's like, well, that's really not possible. What's your real name? You know, let's figure this out. And in fact, he's got the antagonists in the form of, you know, Colonel Flagg and some of the more, you know, straight-laced guys, you know, openly mocking the fact that he's Jesus. But you have to say to yourself, what if, you know,
right.
I mean, you know, and I encourage everyone to see the episode because the actor who gives a performance does it perfectly. The writing is perfect. You know, this is probably how Jesus would sound if he showed up there. And Father Mulcahy, you know, kind of doesn't quite know what to make of it. But the poignant moment in the entire episode is when you realize at the end the only one who believed him all along was innocent little Radar.
Radar, yeah, no, and it's interesting. Actually, even the development of the Radar character is interesting, but in that episode specifically, the power of his naive kind of persona, his Iowa born and raised small town guy. Like you said, there's a few moments before that final scene where he's interacting with him. He gets him an extra orange juice so that he remembers him in the first place. It's a really touching way, exactly like you said, maybe for even a child to come across Jesus Christ.
Right. And you know, again, it makes us all ask, suppose the guy shows up at work.
Right.
You know, so, and oh, okay, you know, and we just don't believe him. But Gary Berghoff pulled off that one off just fantastically. It's ironic because from what I understand, some of the characters on the screen compared to their off-screen personas were exactly the opposite. Larry Linville played Frank Burns, Ferret Face, who just everybody couldn't stand on screen.
Yeah.
And yet among the cast off the screen during production, he was a very, very amiable, very nice guy.
Wow.
Everybody loved him. Exactly the opposite with Gary Berghoff.
Oh, interesting.
Radar was this adorable little lovable thing on the screen. Off the screen, apparently
not so much.
Well, you know, he was kind of a perfectionist, and you know, I believe one of the quotes was when he finally left the series about 2/3 of the way through the seasons, they said he won't be missed because he just
he's a Chevy Chase.
Yeah,
is what you're saying.
Kind of, yeah.
Interesting. What I really enjoyed about Radar is the first couple seasons. The character was a little bit different. He
You're
changed
right.
throughout. When
you
he
picked
was,
up on that, yep.
Yeah, when he first started, the character seemed a lot less naive. He seemed a lot more...
Right.
He was one of the guys that was pulling things off in the camp, and he was doing it in a very different way. Because the Radar character continues to pull off these incredible feats. He gets them a centrifuge or something like that for the camp because
the
they
incubator.
Really need one. The incubator, thank you. Yeah, he gets them things like that, and in the later seasons, he does it in a very innocent kind of, I don't know, that...
You notice that, and you're right. You're absolutely right. But I think it also has to do with the overall writing of the show.
Mm-hmm.
When MASH started in its first season, it was a lot more like the movie. It was kind of avant-garde. It was, you know, sort of quirky, and they were going for a certain, you know, texture to the show where it was all about the characters as opposed to the story arc.
Right.
And when you do, you know, 21 episodes a season or whatever, eventually your story arc's going to need to expand. Mm-hmm. So they're going to need to make the characters a little bit more dynamic.
Well, that's why I would tell anyone to watch the show, not just because it's an incredible show and that it stands up better than any other show I've watched that is this dated. It stands up better than any other one that I've seen in this podcast or probably ever. I also think it's kind of a textbook way on how a show can go from creation to completion and just change in the most satisfying ways possible and become a much more fulfilling experience for a viewer than maybe, like you said, when it started. In the first season, it could have been canceled today.
Right.
But thank God that it was created when it was, because what it became and how it fleshed out exactly what you were going to get in your 22 minutes each week, I don't think there's anything really like it. I can't compare anything to this show. And I think there's a lot of things that this show did that now is done all the time. Like you said, the season finales, they were so wonderful and so consistent. And that is what most shows aspire to be now. The season finale, everything is put into, let's make all the big moments hit in one episode at the end of the season.
Well, when you think about a show like this and where it's coming from comedically and where it's coming from writing-wise and style-wise, you know, I think in 2015, a show like this would make you think more like Netflix or HBO or one of the cable networks produced it up because it's, you
because
know,
it's good.
Yeah. The sitcoms, well, because it's different.
You know,
and they're going for a specific audience. And I think MASH was from a day when the networks, the major networks used to think that too. But, you know, now you look at the sitcoms, you know, and they're chuckle fests basically. I mean,
well, we mentioned a couple characters. Let's make sure not to leave out too many of the other important ones. Who are some of your favorite characters in the show outside of Hawkeye, Radar?
Well, I have to admit, I mean, if you have all the, and all, by the way, every MASH episode and all the seasons are available on Netflix, but there's the first three seasons, which is the original ensemble.
Yep.
There's BJ, or I'm sorry, there's Hawkeye, there's Trapper, Radar, Hot Lips Houlihan. Frank Burns, and of course, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake, played by McLean Stevenson.
True.
And then everything changes at the end of the third season.
Yep.
You've got the episode, the season finale called Abyssinia Henry, where they give him a huge send-off. And
talk about a build-up in that one episode, actually, real quick. That was... I didn't see that coming at all, and I guess I should
have. All of America didn't see that
coming. Right, well, but it's fascinating that
CBS was flooded with thousands of letters for weeks after that episode.
Yeah.
How dare you do this to us?
Because what they did is, for anyone that doesn't know, although outside of myself, I'm not sure there are that many people.
Okay, spoiler alert,
Spoiler alert here. What they did at the end of an episode that was completely dedicated to saying goodbye to what I think would be a beloved character.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. At the very end, Radar comes back in the surgical room. You don't see the characters anymore, and this is really just a quick, like, 1 minute of the episode, and Radar announces that he died, that he got shot down.
He's been killed in a plane crash.
Yeah. On his way home, after calling his wife, after all the things that happened in that episode.
Oh, they got drunk, they said goodbye.
Oh, my God.
You know, a lot of very funny moments.
Yeah.
And many of the sitcoms of the era had that last, they'd have the last commercial break, and then they'd come back for one last little, you know, funny line or whatever before the credits roll. And Radar comes in and
just completely
and there's
emotionally
you know, there's obviously some legend to this story. Everybody, you know, one of the common myths is that when he came in and announced that, that was the first time the cast had heard it.
Wow.
It's not true, but it's almost true.
It's cool.
Yeah. They on the last day of filming, they were going to do this final scene. They told everybody to wait a little longer. And then they were going to have their cast season wrap party right there on the set, which, by the way, the outdoor set is about 22 miles northwest of Los Angeles in a national park or in a state park. You can actually, there's still like rusted Jeeps out there.
Awesome.
Yeah. But then, of course, they had the set at 20th Century Fox. So they told everybody to hang around, and they sat down the main performers. They sat down Alan Alda, Wayne Rogers, and Larry Linville, and they read them the final script. So all of these people knew it was coming.
Wow.
So they get everybody together in the operating room, and the director yells action, and Radar comes in and makes the announcement, and it's like this huge bombshell. And something about the film cartridge or something screwed up. And so they had to take it again. And the director was like, there's no way I'm going to get that feeling again. But Gary Berghoff turns right around, comes right back in. And that's the scene you see. He says, you know, I have a message. You know, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake's plane was shot down over the Sea of Japan. It spun in. There were no survivors. And the camera slowly pans across the operating room. Loretta Swit, Hot Lips Houlihan, is crying. Yep. There's tears in Alan Alda's eyes. And during the pan, you actually hear the medical instrument drop. And that was
you hear a pin drop.
Yeah, that was one of the, you know, one of the background people just dropping the thing. And, you know, it wasn't in the, but the director was like, that made the scene right there.
Yeah.
Because it was like, everybody was like, holy crap.
Yeah, no, I mentioned to you that, that my first takeaway from watching episodes of the show was how great the season finales were. And there's no way that after that one, they could have done anything other than continue to try.
Right.
To, and there was nothing as good
as like
as
I said, it was quite a culture shock when that happened.
Yeah.
I mean, there were stories about it. And then, of course, in season four, we get the arrival of Colonel Sherman Potter, Harry Morgan, who's an old school sitcom guy.
Yep, Dragnet.
An old school, television guy. He's actually, if you look at the second season, he actually plays in an episode with Colonel Blake. He is a crazy general. In fact,
what?
I think it's the first episode of the second season. He comes in as this nutty general who's, you know, inspecting the MASH unit. So, yeah, Harry Morgan is, you know, a completely different guy in that episode. But obviously a year and a half later when they needed
to cast. Yeah, nobody will remember.
Yeah,
that's
nobody
fine.
Will remember. So Harry Morgan comes in and B.J. Honeycutt comes in.
Right, and they don't. Wayne Rogers doesn't even actually appear in the episode.
Right.
They.
Right. Yeah. Well, that was. Yeah. They kind of did that kind of cleverly, but they made it like, you know, he just left, and
right.
Now Mike Farrell, his character B.J. Honeycutt shows up, and then Frank Burns hangs around for a couple of years. Now I was an original ensemble guy. I loved Ferret Face. I
sure.
thought there was. It's just so something so deliciously miserable about Ferret Face. But, and in fact,
I agree with you.
I think we all know a ferret face.
We
know?
Do, yeah.
But Larry Linville, after his 5-year run, just kind of decided, you know what, my character is getting more and more snotty, and they're right. not taking it in any new direction.
No, he becomes very one dimensional.
If you notice, one character that did absolutely pull a 180 from when they first started writing her. To the later episodes was Loretta Swit.
Hot Lips Houlihan.
Yeah. She was just this.
Oh, yeah. She was absolutely his number two, essentially, in the beginning.
Yeah. And she eventually grew a soul. And became, you know, she never really lost that tenacity or that by the book, you know, army gung-ho-ness. But she certainly, her heart opened up and she became. Friends, you know, with BJ and,
right.
and Hawkeye later on. And then David Ogden Steers shows up, and that's Charles Emerson Winchester,
yep.
who is exactly, he's the antagonist, but he's exactly the opposite of Frank Burns. Frank Burns was a lousy doctor. Charles Emerson Winchester is, in many ways, better than Hawkeye.
Right.
Frank Burns, you know, was all by the book. Charles Emerson Winchester was all by the buck, the money.
Mm-hmm.
He was all about cash, you know. And his sort of character arc over the seasons, too, changed as well. You know, he became a different person, too.
Yeah. Which, again, is one of the most powerful things about the show is that how believably they develop these characters, how much more cynical Hawkeye becomes as each season progresses and he's still there. And I thought it was interesting that as characters get sent home, it does continue to impact him and he continues to think. He gets darker and darker, for sure, I think, as the seasons go on.
That has a lot to do with Alan Alda.
Right.
You know, he had gotten more and more creative control. In fact, I think a lot of MASH hardcore fans will start rolling their eyes a little bit towards some of the latter seasons because
really?
Some of them just got weird.
Yeah.
You know, there's a dream episode where everybody's, you know, living through their dreams, their nightmares and everything. There's nothing funny about it. It's fascinating, but it's dark and it's, you know, it's like, oh, really? So, but Alan Alda by then had, you know, this huge control over the episodes and it had stopped becoming a sitcom in the traditional sense of the word.
For sure.
And it became a 30-minute, you know, drama.
So I have to ask you this, and this is kind of off topic a little bit, but Alan Alda and Howard Stern have the same voice, right? Especially then. Especially MASH Alan Alda. It is the exact same voice, the same cadence. They sound... You could replace one for the other.
I could see that, yeah. I think that, in fact, I think they're both from New York, so that makes sense.
Right. So some of the early episodes in the first few seasons, especially when he's being a sillier version of that character... I started to picture Howard Stern in those episodes.
Well, you know, it's funny you're going in this direction, and I'm glad you did, because Hawkeye Pierce in the early episodes, in the early seasons, really throughout the run of the show, but particularly in the early seasons, was the quintessential smartass.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, he just had
he was,
you know,
Howard Stern.
He was. He had a one-liner. He could top everyone. And it's funny, when I was a little kid, I mean, I guess the reruns had started by like 1977, 78, well into it. These, my grandfather watching days, I suppose. And, you know, I'm 10, 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And you know, every kid gets bullied to a certain extent. We all kind of go through it in school for one reason or
sure.
another. And I was no exception. You know, there were I was right at that age where, you know, you're kind of
sure.
coming out of mommy and daddy's shadow.
Cocoon.
And you're on your own for a couple of hours
right.
every day. And, you know, I just noticed that, you know, the cool kids were kind of ganging up on me now and then. And honestly, even at the age of like 11 and 12, I was inspired by Hawkeye Pierce.
Wow.
You know, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to be the kid who's going to fight everyone,
right.
you know, for my honor.
But I'm at least going to make fun of them verbally.
But I'm at least going to make fun of them verbally and often in ways that go right over their heads. You know, that was my quest. I wanted to be a smartass, but yeah. I wanted to be a smartass where only I got it. And it worked like
a charm.
I'll
tell you, the kids didn't think that was very cool, but that to me sounds very cool. You sound like a very cool kid to me now as an adult. I'm sure adults loved you.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, got some weird eyes, some side eyes and stuff, but, you know, and it really there was no payoff because when you're being too clever against the third grade bully or the fourth grade bully,
I don't know, you had such an emotional payoff internally though that like,
that's right. The payoff was for me.
Right. No one else got it. You're right. There
I would
was
walk
no...
away. Everybody would be just chuckling or whatever. And I'd walk away and go, that's exactly what Hawkeye would say. That's exactly what
they have no idea how cool I am.
So
right now.
Seriously, you know, I mean, I would encourage any, younger folks who, you know, still have, confidence issues when they're going up against, mm-hmm. You know, and not even just bullies, but just like, you know, people who think they know it all, watch a little, Hawkeye Pierce and learn from him.
I would say to anyone that likes television, and I assume if I have any regular listeners to this podcast, you have to like television at this point. You have to be very into TV. If you haven't seen this show, you have to watch it. MASH right. is something that you have to see right. because of all the stuff that we discussed, all the reasons why it was such a trendsetter, such a trailblazer when it was happening. I've said this several times in the podcast, and I've joked before that sometimes I mean it, sometimes I don't. Everyone has to watch this show. And if you've seen it, but it's been a long time, it's on Netflix. Go back and watch MASH.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And if there's anything else you feel like we left out, is there something you want to say about the show? I know there's a lot.
Well, there's, you know, there's a couple of, you know, urban legends out there. One is that Hawkeye only saluted like twice. That's not true. He saluted several times.
Yeah, I remember.
Many times. Yeah. Let's see. What's another urban legend? Well, it's not a legend. It's a fact. The final episode of MASH, the special episode that wrapped up the series, mm-hmm. was and probably will forever be the highest rated television show in American television history.
Right.
I think something like 38 million people were watching that episode. And
yeah.
they say because, you know, because of cable TV now and because, you know, back then there were three networks. Now there's 300. They'll really never meet that number again. And so, you know, it clearly the country was into it. And then, of course, there was the theme song, which we played coming in.
Yep.
We'll play a little bit going out, too. A lot of people don't know that the what sounds like just sort of a quirky 1970s theme song, the instrumental opening of the MASH episode, mm-hmm. actually had lyrics.
Oh, they are tough.
And
they're hard lyrics.
The song is called Suicide is Painless.
Yeah. For anyone that doesn't know, we're recording tonight's episode in Chris's studio, and it's a square studio, and when you close the door, it's just the two of us in here, man.
Right.
And we're listening to these lyrics, and I almost cried. I almost had a full-on cry.
Yeah,
from just one other dude.
It's a perfect song for MASH, and
it really
shows you where they were trying to be when they put the show on the air. They mm-hmm. wanted some of the avant-garde edginess of the movie.
Yeah.
They wanted that to transcribe. So we'll wrap things up here and we'll play the Suicide is
That
Painless.
Sounds great, man. Go ahead and do it.
The theme for MASH with lyrics.
Yeah, here we go.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me. I realize and I can see. that suicide is painless. It brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please. The game of life is hard to play. I'm gonna lose it anyway. The losing card I'll someday lay. So this is all I have to say. Suicide is painless.
Suicide.
It brings on many changes.
Changes.
And I can take or leave it if I please. The sword of time will pierce our skin. It doesn't hurt when it begins, but as it works its way on in, the pain grows stronger, watch it grieve. Suicide is painless, it brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please. A brave man once requested me answer questions that are key. Is it to be or not to be? And I replied, oh, why ask me? Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes. And I can take or leave it if I please.